WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In the late 70s, Norman Rush and his wife were co-directors of the Peace Corps program in Botswana in southern Africa. When he returned to the States in 1983, Rush began to write stories about the American presence in Africa. First came his book of stories, Whites. His latest book, a novel called Mating, just won the National Book Award for Fiction. Mating is a comedy of manners about courtship and utopian fantasies. The story revolves around two characters, a young female anthropologist and an older male scientist. The scientist has created a haven for destitute African women in the middle of the Kalahari Desert. Rush has written the story in the woman's voice. I asked him to read from the opening page of his book.
In Africa, you want more, I think. People get avid. This takes different forms in different people, but it shows up in some form in everybody who stays there any length of time. It can be sudden. I include myself. Obviously, I mean whites in Africa and not black Africans. The average black African has the opposite problem. He or she doesn't want enough. A whole profession called rural animation exists, devoted to making villagers want more and work harder to get it. Africans are pretty ungreedy. Elites accepted, naturally. Elites are elites. But in Africa, you see middle-class white people you know for a fact are highly normal turn overnight into chain smokers or heavy drinkers or gourmets. Suddenly, you find otherwise serious people wedged in among the maids of the truly rich in the throng at the Chinese butchery, their faces clenched, determined to come away with one of the 9 or 10 half pints of creme fraiche that arrive from Mafeking on Wednesdays at 3. You see people fixate on eating wonderfully despite the derisory palette Botswana offers. Or they may get into quantity sex. Or you can see it strike them that there's no reason they shouldn't take a stab at getting rich before they have to leave Africa. Most expatriates can only stay for a few years, and like clockwork, when they get toward the end, they start buying up carasses or carvings to resell, or they decide to buy real estate through Botswana proxies, or in one case, to found the first peewee golf course south of the Sahara. I knew someone who was an ect mama's boy in real life who took insane risks smuggling wristwatches into Zimbabwe on weekends. He was at the very end of his contract. He was teaching law at the University of Botswana.
You were a member of the Foreign Service, and you and your wife actually directed the Peace Corps program in Botswana.
That's right. Yes, we did.
What took you to Botswana?
Well, two things, I think, together. One was a desire for adventure and the opportunity to look into strata of life that would otherwise forever be closed to us. And the other was a chance to do a little good, maybe, if we were lucky. So it was an irresistible combination.
This is Botswana of the late 70s and early 80s.
Right, 78 to 83.
What was the political, cultural climate there at the time?
Well, for us, it was, I guess you could say, you could describe Botswana as being an island of tranquility surrounded by conflict, armed struggle, everywhere you looked. In Namibia, there was the Swapo rebellion was going on. Zimbabwe, the guerrilla war was coming to an end there. In South Africa, apartheid was in crisis, of course, and in those days, Botswana was the first port of call for people leaving, refugees and exiles, and the South Africans had not yet electrified the border fence along the Limpopo, so people were wading across and coming in that way. And
was it geography, then, that made Botswana this kind of haven?
Yeah, Botswana became this kind of tranquil place because it was in everybody's interest for it to be that way. And all of the major powers had some sort of representation there because everyone had a stake in how it came out in South Africa. And, of course, the South Africans had their own special branch people undercover in Botswana. So it was a climate that was intensely alive politically, and you were never quite sure who was who in that situation.
What kind of programs did the Peace Corps have there? What kinds of things were they trying to promote?
We supplied teachers for secondary schools, drought relief workers, borehole mechanics, that is people who were training local people to run diesel pumps, tuberculosis control, a broad range, small business development, agriculture. It was a broadly based program of about 120 volunteers, 100 to 120 volunteers over the time span we were there.
I'm curious about the outsiders, even the white people that came to Botswana. You described being there, you wanted to do some good, and you were looking, I guess, for something else. Would you say that characterized other people as well?
Well, it's different for different categories of people. I think that I'm rather hard on the Brits in this book, and I think that a lot of the Brits who were there for a different reason. They were there because they had had it pretty good up further up in Africa, and as decolonization had rolled them down further and further south, they'd gotten more and more disgruntled, and yet they were not prepared to go back to cloudy England ever. Americans coming into that part of the world come in with a feeling of very clean hands, I think mistakenly, but since they were never original colonizers, they feel that they come in as an ex-colonial, as a representation of ex-colonial intelligence and intentions, and they're not seen that way, of course. So it makes for a very interesting mixture of political attitudes.
Did you have, I'm wondering, even at the sort of end of your term in the Foreign Service or with the Peace Corps, could you have stayed on if you wanted to?
Well, Peace Corps has a rule, which is called a five-year rule. Then that's, you're out after that, because the notion was that they did not want to create a permanent bureaucracy, revolving. So they want new blood.
Were you ready to go?
We were very tired, yeah, at the end of 5 years. It's a grueling job. And in fact, I didn't get any writing done while I was in Africa. It was all in the future. I took notes. I brought back tapes and maps and notes of all kinds of things. But there was never any time. It's a 24-hour-a-day job being Peace Corps director.
And were you even doing any kind of mental writing?
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. There's no way that I found it so literarily stimulating that there was no way that I wasn't starting stories in my head the whole time. And when I did sit down, when I got back to the United States, everything came very rapidly to me. So clearly some kind of unconscious process of composition had been underway.
I think people that have never been to Africa or certainly the various and variety of countries in Africa don't understand what a rich environment that is. I think, mm-hmm. I mean, we read, of course, about the terrible famines, the starvations, the civil wars, which are all very real.
Yeah.
But there's this other part of it, and perhaps even only well-off people get a chance to participate in that.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what that is?
Well, it's the variety of life in Africa is in a way misrepresents what you find in Botswana, because life is concentrated very much in the southern and eastern part of the country. It's a big country. It's huge. It's as big as France or Texas. When we were there, it had a population of about 1 million, and that population was mostly concentrated in the strip along the border with South Africa leading up toward Zimbabwe, where the railway was, the railway line was. But in the north is a very exotic and different kind of society and kind of country. There's a beheaded river up there, which produces an inland delta called the Okavango Swamp, which is the last great unfenced game area in the world. And in the desert, you have Basarwa, Bushmen, living the last hunter-gatherers. Not very many of them actually hunting and gathering anymore, if you read my book, but bands of them in the Kalahari. And spread out across the country, isolated settlements of people evolving and becoming and surviving in their own way, utterly in their own way. So it appears to be a blank, but uh-huh. But it's not.
Well, how does that get under your skin?
Well, it gets under your skin because you want to understand it. You want to understand how people can live, for example, how people can live with equanimity in the midst of what looks like total desolation, have normal lives, clusters of families in the midst of an absolute desolation, little path leading off to ultimately to a trek route. You would think that this would lead to a sort of impoverished life, but when you get to know these people, you discover enormous qualities and interest in life and everything that makes another human being interesting.
Does that solve a kind of riddle then that you have about human nature?
No, it only adds to it. Right. I think I'm not closer to solving the mystery of the world, as my narrator calls it. But let me just also say, there's another thing about Africa's an astonishing place, and you see things that you're not prepared for all the time. This is kind of a trivial example, but it illustrates the kind of aesthetics shocks that you receive. We were passing through a segment of the Kalahari Desert and came over a rise, and there on the ground in front of us across the roadway were indescribable objects, indescribably beautiful and enigmatic, not identifiable. And it took us a while to figure out what they were. It was late afternoon. The sun was shining in a sort of golden way on these things. And we stopped and discovered that what we were looking at were clods of elephant dung, spherical, quite large. A herd had obviously passed that way. And each clod of dung had been colonized by a different species of butterfly. So these things looked like surreal Christmas tree ornaments distributed across the road, waving, the wings waving, and the colors iridescent and magical. But from 20 feet away, you could not understand what you were seeing.
Norman Rush is my guest today, and from 1978 until the early 80s, for 5 years, he and his wife ran the Peace Corps program in Botswana. They were members of the Foreign Service. He's written 2 books. His first one is called Whites, and his latest one is called Mating. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Norman Rush is my guest. You spent some time, in fact, many years, as a rare books dealer.
Right, that was, yeah.
And was it, was there something about being surrounded, and I guess I have this image of this, you know, mountain of rare books, and somehow you in
that's
the center
very
of it.
That's very close to the unfortunate truth, and I still haven't cleared the decks. My wife I've made promises to her about this, and I'm still clinging to my stock.
I see perhaps these two streams of influences, and I guess I think of these old books and the kind of rich language and mm-hmm. perhaps old stories. And then I think of perhaps even the correspondence that you had to do in the Peace Corps, which I imagine is, you know, very terse kind of writing. And I see kind of evidences of both those in Mating.
Well, yes, you probably do, and also some of the miscellaneous saning up of odd facts turned my characters. I've shared that trait with at least one of the characters. That's true. The interest in words also is something that I think people have remarked on the vocabulary of the narrator. And been kind of made much of it. I don't really think that it's that extraordinary for somebody who is coming upward from the underclass to seize on language and a command of language as a way of demonstrating power in the world. And I've known people like this in academic and sub-academic circles. So she's not a willful invention. Mm-hmm. But I confess also to an interest in words, and I think that it's fun to think about how this medium that we use to connect to one another, and how imperfect and how comical it is at times.
Does that mean, as a writer, you go over and over and over to, because the importance of the words to you, that it takes a long time to get them right?
Yeah, I have a perfectionist tendency. I have to say. Although I do not as many drafts as other writers do, but I do a lot of thinking before I write. And it's one reason that I haven't been attracted to the word processor, because so much of what goes on is sort of pre-sorted before I get it down.
Well, how would a word processor inhibit that?
Well, I think people tend to write a great deal, then look at it, and then change it. And I tend to internally do what happens on the screen and then get it down. And I've never adapted to the idea of, I don't think that print appearing on a screen is the same thing. Typing is almost like publishing, I mean, for me in a certain way. So I'm staying with my primitive typewriter, for the time being anyway.
Does that mean non-electric or electric?
No, non-electric. it's a genuine antique, and I'm so wedded to the typeface. It's an elite face that doesn't exist anymore in the world, so I don't know. I think maybe I'll be in trouble when this thing goes.
Norman Rush is my guest. In his latest book, it's a novel, is called Mating. You were a conscientious objector. This is going back many years. Conscientious objector.
It's going way back, yeah.
During the Korean War.
Right.
And actually went to prison.
Yes.
Would you say this kind of activism, I assume, and this kind of opinionated feelings about politics, has that really continued then through your life?
I have to say yes. I'm still opinionated. I'm still a pacifist. I went to prison because there was no accommodation in the law for someone who was opposed to war and who was not religious. I was objected on moral grounds, but not religious grounds, to war and to killing. And there are echoes of that, of course, in the book throughout. And I haven't changed my views, at least on those issues, and over time.
How did you spend your time in prison?
I worked in the boiler room mostly at night, which was where we burned logs to generate electricity and steam and heat for the prison camp. This was in Tucson, Arizona, minimum security prison in the Catalina Rincon Mountains. I was there for 9 months of a 2-year sentence. I was paroled directly to, almost directly to Swarthmore College, where I proceeded to fall in love with the daughter of the special agent in charge of the FBI in New York City. And if you want to talk about unlikely matings, that the prospects were certainly odd for that one.
Did you feel angry that you had to serve time in prison, or did you feel that was the price of your beliefs?
No, that was par for the course. And I mean, I felt the usual things that a young man feels, all of the questions as to whether cowardice was involved in what I was doing, some unconscious level. So the tiny ordeal that I went through was something I was completely prepared to accept. And actually, it was a fascinating experience, too, although I haven't written about it, but it was.
Fascinating as you look back on
it? Yeah, looking back on it, the people that I met there and the things it did to my way of looking at the world.
Can you be more descriptive?
Well, once you've been in jail, you look at the world differently. You see that you taste what the real sanction is in the making of society, and changes your sympathies, I think, in some profound way. Also, in those days, I was still, you still remained subject to selective service. I was, until I was about 25 or 26, was still subject to being recalled and having to go through the whole process again. So it gave me a kind of a fugitive outlook on things while this was going, and nourished the oppositional side of my perceptions, I think.
Did you come from a pacifist family?
Yes. My father ultimately became a pacifist, although he became many other things, too. He started out as a socialist and as an organizer for the Socialist Party in California and a union organizer. When I was born, he received instructions from my mother that all this had to stop and he had to get a job that would pay something. And he became the opposite of what he had been. He became a salesman and a trainer of salesmen. And his intellectual trajectory ultimately took him to Rosicrucianism and theosophy.
Huh.
But at one small segment in there, he was a pacifist, and it was there that I got my first introduction to pacifist ideas.
And did he support then you're going to jail?
Oh, yes, yeah, he understood that. There was never any question about that.
The dedication, or at least the very beginning of your book, is a very powerful and emotional. It's very powerful and emotional. I was wondering if you could read it for us.
Sure. Everything I write is for Elsa, but especially this book, since in it her heart, sensibility, and intellect are so signally, if perforce esoterically, celebrated and exploited. My debt to her in art and in life grows, however much I put against it. I also dedicate mating to my beloved son and daughter-in-law, Jason and Monica, to my mother and to the memory of my father, and to my lost child, Liza. And to explain the last, I have a daughter who's now 30, who was born with diffuse brain atrophy and has been institutionalized for many years. But I think the rest is pretty self-explanatory.
What is her condition? I mean,
she is profoundly retarded and will be so.
So you feel she's lost to you?
Yes, there is no recognition possible between her and us.
Well, what really struck me about that very beginning was just this sense of family that I got. Mm-hmm. I mean, family in the sort of the deepest sense of the word.
Uh-huh. Well, yes, and it's kind of an achievement too. We went through probably the most ferocious adolescence with our son that any family ever survived. And it's now turned out it's all in the past and everything is wonderful, but it was a severe test. He is a mathematician at the University of Washington in Seattle, and he chose mathematics specifically as something that neither one of us had anything to do with. No politics, no art. My wife is a weaver and a textile designer. No politics, no art. So this was his choice. But he's... We have a terrific family relationship now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today.
It was my great pleasure.
Norman Rush is the author of Mating, which won the National Book Award for Fiction. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.